Today is October 18th, I believe, 2009, and the title of my Dharma talk is Why is Everyone Too Busy? I'm going to start off with an article from Salon.com. It's a website full of the sort of conversation, I suppose, that you'd hear in a literary salon, perhaps, updated a bit for the 21st century. The title of this is this particular article is Why Can't We Concentrate? It's written by Laura Miller, and it was posted, I guess, on April 29th of this year. And the little sort of sub-blurb says, Twitter and email aren't making us stupider, but they are making us more distracted. A new book explains why learning to focus is the key to living better. And she starts off by saying, here's a fail-safe topic when making conversation with everyone, from cab drivers to grad students to cousins in the construction trade. Mention the fact that you're finding it harder and harder to concentrate lately. The complaint appears to be universal, yet everyone blames it on some personal factor, having a baby, starting a new job, turning 50, having to use a BlackBerry for work, getting on Facebook, and so on. This creeping distractibility and the technology that presumably causes it has inspired such cri de coeur as Nicholas Carr's much discussed Is Google Making Us Stupid? Essay for the Atlantic Monthly and diatribes like The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, a book published last year by Mark Bauerlein. You don't have to agree that we are getting stupider or that today's youth are going to hell in a handbasket, by gum, to mourn the withering away of the ability to think about one thing for a prolonged period of time. Carr, whose argument was grievously mislabeled by the Atlantic's headline writers, that's the Is Google Making Us Stupid, as a salvo against the ubiquitous search engine, reported feeling the change most strongly when he was reading. This is something that really resonates with me. Immersing myself in a book or a lengthy article used to be easy, he wrote. Now my concentration often starts to drift after two or three pages. I get fidgety, lose the thread, begin looking for something else to do. I feel as if I'm always dragging my wayward brain back to the text. Then the author, this Laura Miller, chimes in, for my own part, I now find it challenging to sit still on my sofa through the length of a feature film. The urge to, for example, jump up and check the IMDb filmography of a supporting actor is well nigh irresistible, and once I'm at the computer, why not check email? Most of the time, I'll wind up pausing the DVD player before the end of the movie and telling myself I'll watch the rest tomorrow. This sound familiar to anybody? Says this is no mere Luddite's lament. For anybody who doesn't know what a Luddite is, it's one of the earliest movements against technology. Actually, saboteur is another word that came into use when technology was getting going. A sabah or sabat, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, is a shoe, a sandal, a wooden sandal, and saboteurs would throw them in the cogs of machinery to try to stave off the Industrial Revolution. So we have saboteurs and we have Luddites. Can't remember exactly. The Luddite, I think, was somebody named Luddite. That's a guess. A couple years ago, a craze for, quote, full-screen mode writing software like WriteSpace and WriteRoom swept through the web's various digital communities devoted to productivity tips and tricks favored by technology workers. These applications reduce a computer's display to a simple black screen with a column of text running down the middle. Sounds nice. My colleague Rebecca Traister wrote recently of her love affair with Freedom, a program that locks her computer off the internet for a preset block of time so she can, quote, get some goddamn work done, end quote, a desperate measure she characterized as a bid to, quote, protect me from myself. And then she sums it up very nicely. What this commonplace crisis comes down to is our inability to control our own minds. It seems strange that this should even be a problem for somebody practicing Zen Buddhism. Speaking for myself, it is. I find that my life is more interrupt-driven than it's ever been. And, you know, I can say, well, it's my job, I'm head of Zendo, and every 5 minutes somebody knocks on my door to complain about somebody else. There is a lot of that. And of course, you know, when I when I'm trying to get in touch with somebody, I give them my cell phone number and tell them, you know, call me whenever. And so, sure enough, you know, I'm Wednesday evening date night with my wife, watching a DVD, and here comes the phone call. Obviously, I could do things to prevent that more than I do. But it is the flavor of modern life, and it's not just people who are working on computers. It really seems to be just, I think finally Ronald Reagan's trickle down theory has come to life, because the constant busyness, the constant interrupts, the trying to do more with less resources. And of course, we're able to do that supposedly because of the computer and other productivity tools. This is affecting everyone, and it's not just computers. It's the economy, and it's the drive to make profits in a difficult economic environment. But it seems like everybody is finding themselves with less and less free time, and the free time they do have somehow gets chewed up in little joyless entertainments. It's like an addict that doesn't even enjoy his drug anymore. And it's, you know, there is when you first learn a new program or get a new computer or get on Facebook or all these other things, it's just wonderful. It's amazing what you can do. There's a video, you can see it on YouTube. I recommend the comedian Louis C.K. has a bit that he did on the Conan O'Brien show, and the title is "Everything's Amazing and Nobody's Happy." It's just, I can remember even as a child thinking how incredible that you can pick up a phone, dial 10 numbers in sequence, and talk to anyone. Anyway, and it works every time. You dial the number and you get that phone. Of course, I say it works every time. Yesterday evening, I had to call Roshi for something he needed in Madison. And I've never had this happen before, but I called him up. And I dialed his number. It was programmed right into my cell phone, so I know I got it right. And there was somebody else on the line, so I tried to talk to them, and they didn't seem to be responding to me, so I hung up. I dialed again, and I got Roshi, who had received and heard my previous phone call and couldn't understand why I couldn't hear him. So somehow in the the amazingness broke down for a little bit. I was talking to somebody who I don't know. I spent a little time wondering what they were hearing while I was hearing them. But still, it's amazing. And Louis C.K. talks about how the fact is, you know, the minute we've got these things, we take them totally for granted, and then when they don't work, or when they're slow to work, we're absolutely aggrieved. Points out people with their cell phones cursing their cell phones and, you know, wondering why the call won't go through. And finally, in exasperation, he says, "It's going to space." Or a guy gets on a plane and I shouldn't be doing his comedy routine, but he'd never before seen these things where you can get on the internet right on the plane. I saw somebody on Facebook remarking about that yesterday. Anyway, the guy next to him is trying to do it and something goes wrong. All of a sudden the internet goes down and the guy says, "This is bullshit." 5 minutes ago you didn't know this existed. I can remember having one of those old TVs with a dial that you turned and a volume switch on the TV and thinking what heaven it would be if there was some way to turn the volume down during the commercials. And I went so far as in my head to devise some sort of a stick that would, from my chair, it would reach the volume knob and I could turn it down. And actually I had a friend who worked on a similar device, which he was going to call the blab off. And now we have it, you know, you don't even think about it. Hit the mute button. Come on, Dad. It's all these wonderful things, but as Louis C.K. says, nobody's any happier. They're not making us any happier. They're making us maybe they're making us more productive. They're certainly allowing us to move quickly from one thing to another. And this is where so much of the discontent is coming from, is just touched on here in what I read. The fact that we no longer stick with anything, or we tend not to stick with anything for any length of time. I have noticed this thing of having difficulty immersing myself in a book, and I've always thought, well, that's because in the back of my mind I'd rather be doing Zazen. This is sort of taking me away from my practice. But I'm not so sure. I think that it's the habit, the rhythm of moving from one bright, shiny object to another is getting into me and I think a lot of other people. I think it's our, 21st century American gestalt is expecting something new and different to show up all the time. There's somebody who said, and now I can't remember who it was, it just pops into mind, all the problems of man come from his inability to sit alone in a room, or to sit alone quietly in a room. We're fortunate as Zen students that we have some practice in this. But we really are swimming against the current. We're swimming upstream because so much of the culture that we are immersed in, whether we like it or not, is this interrupt-driven type of mindset. Sort of like those dogs. If anybody's seen the movie Up, the dog will be talking along and all of a sudden, squirrel. It's sort of like an addict with a cue. Cues, this is sort of a technical term, but if you have a difficult addiction, whether it's alcohol or a drug or whatever, one of the things you have to struggle with is that something will happen that will sort of trigger your craving for your substance, whatever it is. It could be you're back in a place where you often used to use, or just some remark or a look or something will just sort of trigger that sort of euphoric recall. There's been a lot of study about the neurochemistry of addiction, and a lot of it seems to be connected to the dopamine pathways. It's way too complicated for me to even understand, let alone explain properly. But something I read recently about how dopamine works, for me, shed a lot of light on why you can be constantly sort of giving in to your addictions and not really enjoying it. My crude understanding was always that, you know, you go back to your drug of choice, and I want you to sort of expand the definition of drug of choice to include not only drugs and food and sex, but checking things off a list. That's a drug of choice. You get a little blast of something when you do that. Learning a new fact on the computer, certainly anything on the computer, is an addiction, a drug. Getting praise is a drug. Having a story that you like to tell, getting a chance to tell it, that's a drug. Any time when you see your behavior becoming kind of compulsive, when it's painful not to act on it, you can pretty much say, yeah, I've got some addiction there. There's an unconscious pattern here that's manipulating, by which I'm manipulated. So anyway, whenever some sort of cue comes up, what happens in the brain is it's suddenly flooded with dopamine. And what I used to think was, okay, dopamine must make you feel good, or it triggers other things that make you feel good, and of course we like to feel good, and that's why we keep coming back to it. But then how come, I've got all these addictions and I'm not happy? So what I've read now is that this flood of dopamine comes not with the satisfaction. There's other things that may come into play there. It comes with the cue. It's basically this ancient system in human beings that were designed to say, pay attention to this. So if you are sitting in your hut and all of a sudden a lion roars outside, you're going to get a big shot of dopamine because your brain is telling you, hey, wake up, pay attention. Here it is, squirrel, whatever. And unfortunately, all the sorts of things that computers have made possible play right into the system. So that's why we find ourselves all of a sudden with this urge to complete a word game or play solitaire. I'm listing now my own personal addictions. Look something up on Google, turn our attention from the book we're reading to any number of distractions that are out there. A little cue happens and we switch gears. And the problem is not that this system is in place. It's been in place for the entire history of mankind. The problem is that there are just more and more things that can play into this system, and the more that we indulge it, the more we take the path of non-resistance, the unconscious turning away from the matter at hand to whatever the distraction is, the more we prime that process, the easier it is to do it the next time. It's why it is important to try to learn to swim upstream. It's why it's so crucial not only to get on the mat every day if you possibly can, and as Roshi says, more is better, not only to do that, but to make zazen, make just this habit of being awake, of paying attention, of not responding to every little drive that crosses the threshold of consciousness, to make that kind of absorption in our life as it is, to make that a habit. It's not enough just to sit. It really has to be carried out into our life, and it's a wonderful thing to do. It's where the payoff comes. There's so many people who begin Zen practice and they feel they have a little success at first, and they notice things change, and then they find that things slow down. Everybody has a dry period, and sometimes you run into it pretty quickly. And they just lose the taste. They find other things to do. And there are a million other things to do. And all of a sudden, they're not sitting anymore, and it's hard to get started again, although people do. But if you can just begin to bring some of this silence and directness and simplicity of your sitting into the things you do during the day, regardless of what those things are, they could be interrupt-driven, crazy people pounding into your office, but just to be there to respond, yes, okay. Please go away. Leave me alone. Whatever. Responding as you need to respond, without having this sort of feeling in the back of your mind, this is not right, I don't like this, or ooh, I should like this, I don't like this. You know, to be driven by those sorts of feelings is not going to work. It's not going to work. When you're dissatisfied with the way things are, you're going to look for something that's going to be a simple solution and get you out of it. That's why people turn to drink. That's why people turn to computer solitaire. It's really just get me into some sort of state, mind state, where I'm comfortable. And that's not necessarily where you're truly going to find your happiness. What we can call sort of acceleration of life, acceleration of demands. A lot of it seems to be what happens when you get older. You get out of college, you get a job, your responsibilities multiply, you start a family, you have a house, you need to buy groceries. All these different things happen, and where are the idle, endless summer afternoons of childhood? Well, they don't even exist for our children anymore. Their idle summer afternoons are filled up with soccer practice and band practice and maybe some academic tutoring and whatnot. It's certainly for the upper middle class, everything is structured. There's an article that was written in Forbes magazine back in 1996 by a guy named Mark Helprin, and the title of the article was "The Acceleration of Tranquility." I don't quite understand the title. I looked through the whole article, I read it carefully, and I don't quite understand how tranquility can be accelerated, but what he does is he just lays out two scenarios, and it's done quite nicely, quite poetically. One is somebody in August of 2016, and of course here he is in 1996, so he's looking about 20 years ahead, and I'll read just a little bit from it, just so you can get the flavor. He says, August 2016, California. You are a director of a firm that supplies algorithms for the detection and restoration of damaged molecular memories in organic computation. Previously, you specialized in the repair of cosmic ray degradation of atomic lattices in gallium arsenide nanorobotics. But the greater promise of organic replication and the lure of photon interlinking led you in a new direction. And so on and so forth. What he's predicting for this person in the future is, of course, the ability to talk to anybody anywhere in the world in full holographic vividness, the ability to overlay pornographic images over his wife so they can enjoy sex better, all the different things that technology is perhaps going to bring us if we can just stay alive long enough. So he's off to, this guy is off to Indonesia to meet his wife, who's they're in the middle of a little fight, but you instruct the secretary to allow your wife's apparition to override all others. She is at the beach in Indonesia, where you will shortly join her. Recently, you and she have quarreled. In virtual sex, in which you both wear corneal lenses that create a perfect illusion of whomever you might want, she discovered that you were entertaining not a commercial prostitutional apparition, but an old girlfriend. Hence her early departure for Indonesia. But this is August, the season of vacations, and you and she are bound to make up. You are to take a 1.5-hour suborbital flight to Indonesia. Oh, what joy it will be to get there in 1.5 hours, where you will spend several days at the beach in a primitive resort with no screens. Still, you have a backup of email despite a recent tightening of your rejection protocols and a new investment in automated reply software, the chief disadvantage of which is that when in conversation with other automated reply software, it tends to get overly enthusiastic. You were dismayed lately when you discovered that it and another ARS, that's automated reply software, another ARS were building a golf course in Zimbabwe. But there is software for controlling it and software for controlling the software that controls this and so on and so forth. He says later on, though the screen of your portfolio is electronically textured to feel like paper and is as buff or white as flax or cotton, you miss the days of faxes when you could hold the paper in your hands and when things were a little slower. But you can't go back to them, you can't fall behind, you can't pass up an opportunity, and if you don't respond quickly at all times, somebody else will beat you to it, even if you have no idea what it is. Okay, so that's where we're headed. And now, let's look back. August 1906, Lake Como, Italy. You are an English politician, a member of parliament suffering patiently between cabinet posts on holiday in Italy. In the 2 days it has taken to reach your destination, you have fallen completely out of touch, although you did manage to pick up a day-old Paris newspaper in Turin. The Times will be arriving a week late, as will occasional letters from your colleagues and your business agent. Your answers to most of their queries will arrive in London only slightly before you yourself return at the end of the month. Skipping down a little bit, you will receive an average of one letter every 2 days. 15 or 16 in all, and will write slightly more than that. You are a very busy man for someone on holiday, and wish that you were not. Half the letters will be related to governance, the other half to family and friendship. An important letter written by the Prime Minister 8 days before its reception will elicit from you a one-page response composed over a period of 1.75 hours, and copied twice before it assumes final form for revision, and so you may have a record. You will mail it the next morning when you pass the post office during your walk. The Prime Minister will receive his answer, if he is in London, 2 weeks after his query. He will consider you prompt. During your holiday, you will climb hills, visit chapels, attend 6 formal dinners, and read many books, several thousand pages all told. If upon reading a classical history you come across a Greek phrase with an unfamiliar word, you will have to wait until the library opens. Walk there by the lakeside, and consult a Greek lexicon, 1.5 hours. And on. During August you will hear music 17 times. 5 times it will have been produced by actual musicians, 12 times by a needle tracing the grooves in a cylinder, and echoing songs in extremely melancholy imperfection through a flower-like horn. You cannot imagine a life without deprivations, and without the compensatory power of the imagination, moving like a linnet, with apparent industry and certain grace, to strengthen the spirit in the face of want. Your son went out to India, and you have neither seen him nor heard his voice for 2 years. Thus you have learned once more the perfection of letters, and when you see him again, worlds will have turned, and for the best. It was like that when you were courting your wife. Sometimes you did not see her for weeks or months. It sharpened your desire and deepened your love. You have learned to enjoy the attribute of patience in itself, for it slows time, honors tranquility, and lets you savor a world in which you are clearly aware that your passage is but a brief candle. A bit romantic, perhaps, but it does get at what we've lost. You know, I think it occurred to me that, don't know how many people are familiar with there's a clown whose name is Glenn Beck, who appears on Fox News, and he has a shtick where he starts weeping for his country. And I think a lot of what's driving people like him, they're usually on the right wing of the spectrum, is this sense of loss. That's what happened to life the way I remember it, or life the way I wish I remembered it, or life the way I romanticize it. Things have changed. Things have changed. The kind of week that this diplomat had in 1906 isn't going to come back again. There's a lot that's happened since then, starting with the First World War. So he says, to summarize a little bit, the Englishman at Lake Como, unlike his modern counterpart, is graciously limited in time and space. Because the Prime Minister is in London or at Biarritz, the Prime Minister cannot sit down with him and discuss. In fact, during his fictional stay, only one of his colleagues visited and spent several hours on the terrace with him in the bright but cool sunshine. All others were kept away by the constraints of time and distance. You know, it's interesting to read this as he sort of paints this picture, how often he throws in the little color of the feel of nature and the environment, the sunshine, wind or rain or breeze. When you're sitting in front of a computer screen, when you're living in some sort of virtual reality, that's gone. When you're having virtual sex, that's gone. The man of 1906 doesn't really have to make a conscious choice for his life to open up, to have that kind of space, to have that kind of immediacy and depth. We do. We have to make a choice. Come home from a sitting, you can turn on the radio, or you can go for a walk. You can fire off an email to someone, you can call them on the phone and actually talk to them. It's we're in the situation where we actually have to think about how we want to use our time. I suppose people have always had to make some choice, but the need to do that is tremendous. There's nothing to be gained by bemoaning the fact that, you know, we find ourselves in situations where we are going to be interrupted. There are going to be all kinds of distractions going on. Life is what it is. It's the old thing of God grant me the serenity to change the things I can't, to accept the change. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. I probably got these backwards. To change the things I can. We need to decide what is subject to our control and what is not. And very often we're not quite clear on that. What doesn't help with all of this is to sort of nurse a resentment, a grudge against the way life is, impute some sort of moral failing to computers and technological devices, and especially to the people who use them, and to think ourselves superior when we don't use them. That's not quite it. What we're really looking for is a way in this terrain to find a way to be completely there. And sometimes that's going to mean changing the terrain when that can be done. You know, we can decide, instead of watching a sitcom on TV, to walk the dog. And even though our short-term tendency is to want to do the thing that happens laid back in the chair with the clicker in our hand, we may find, if we can pay attention, that we're happier getting outside, walking with the dog, making the decision to sit. It's so easy not to do that. People so easily fall out of the habit. They find themselves sitting less and less. You hear it in term intensives all the time. People sort of remark with wonder on how much they're enjoying the additional sitting they're doing. And of course the thought comes to mind, well, then how come I didn't do that before? Good question. One of the problems I have with my talk is I have way too much material, thanks to the internet. But really, I think the most useful thing I have, and I'm just going to jump right to it here, is something written by Anthony DeMello. And I wonder if anyone's surprised that I'm trotting him out. I just, you know, I want to resist, but he's just so absolutely on target. So this really bears on this whole question of how do we make peace and work with the disjointed lives that we seem to have fallen into. So he says, someone gave me two situations in which she found it difficult to be aware. She was in a service industry where many people were lined up, many phones were ringing, and she was alone, and there were distractions coming from a lot of uptight, angry people. She found it extremely difficult to maintain serenity and calm. The other situation was when she was driving in traffic with horns blowing and people shouting four-letter words, like stop. She asked me whether eventually that nervousness would dissipate and she would remain at peace. Do you pick up the attachment here? Peace. Her attachment to peace and calm. She was saying, unless I'm peaceful, I won't be happy. Did it ever occur to you that you could be happy in tension? Then he trots out his old canard. Before enlightenment, I used to be depressed. After enlightenment, I continue to be depressed. You don't make a goal out of relaxation and sensitivity. Have you ever heard of people who get tense trying to relax? If one is tense, one simply observes one's tension. You will never understand yourself if you seek to change yourself. This is so basic. Don't seek to change yourself. The harder you try to change yourself, the worse it gets. You are called upon to be aware. Get the feel of that jangling telephone. Get the feel of jarred nerves. Get the sensation of the steering wheel in the car. In other words, come to reality and let tension or the calmness take care of itself. As a matter of fact, you will have to let them take care of themselves because you'll be too preoccupied with getting in touch with reality. Step by step, let whatever happens happen. Real change will come when it is brought about not by your ego, but by reality. Awareness releases reality to change you. This is how Zen practice works. It's not a self-improvement program. It doesn't benefit from our monitoring. It doesn't benefit from our goal orientation. Our task is simply to lose ourselves in the practice, and that means being here in the present. There is no future practice. And being here in the present means we have to be willing to accept things the way they are. We have to accept ourselves the way we are. It's such a truism. And yet, there's a switch. There's probably a lot of switches. There's a little switch where all of a sudden you let go a little bit and you just find yourself no longer pushing your ego-driven agenda. It's a fine line because people can drift into sleepiness and making no effort. Zazen requires a tremendous effort, but it doesn't require an effort at control. In awareness you change, but you've got to experience it. At this point, you're just taking my word for it. He's talking to a group of mostly Catholic lay workers, I think. Perhaps also you've got a plan to become aware. Your ego in its own cunning way is trying to push you into awareness. Watch it. You'll meet with resistance. There will be trouble. There will be blood. When someone is anxious about being aware all the time, you can spot the mild anxiety. They want to be awake to find out if they're really awake or not. Am I doing it right? That's part of asceticism, not awareness. It sounds strange in a culture where we've been trained to achieve goals, to get somewhere, but in fact, there is nowhere to go because you're there already. Another truism. There is nowhere to go because you are there already. As a saying, the unenlightened people are people, no, see, yeah. Ordinary people are people who are enlightened all day long and don't know it. The Japanese have a nice way of putting it. The day you cease to travel, you will have arrived. Your attitude should be, I want to be aware, I want to be in touch with whatever is, and let whatever happens, happens. If I'm awake, fine. And if I'm asleep, fine. The moment you make a goal out of it and attempt to get it, you're seeking ego glorification, ego promotion. You want the good feeling that you've made it. I remember being aware that I wanted to get to a point where I wouldn't have to work anymore. I just wanted, can't I do something that'll get me into the Doksan room, get Roshi to stamp me with his seal of approval, and I can just get out of this bind I seem to have fallen into of Zen practice. Where did I go wrong? When you do make it, you won't know. Your left hand won't know what your right hand is doing. And of course, this is the same as what Dogen says. If you find you've gone all the way, keep going. So that's one side of it, which is, can say, acceptance. The minute we fully accept things as they are, life opens up. It's a key. It's a magic key that truly does open up our lives. Can't always use it, because there's some things we're not ready to accept. Everybody has their limits. But it's an ability that can be expanded. It's a muscle that can be strengthened. We find ourselves being able to accept more and more with some level of equanimity. And once we can do that, then we have a chance to be here. Be awake, be aware, be alive, not be driven. Even if what we're awake and aware of is a constant stream of stimuli, phone calls and interruptions and beeps. But the other side is that it does make sense to change the things we can. Here DeMello says, you need awareness and you need nourishment. You need good, healthy nourishment. Learn to enjoy the solid food of life. Good food, good wine, good water. Taste them. Lose your mind and come to your senses. That's good, healthy nourishment. The pleasures of the senses and the pleasures of the mind. Good reading, when you enjoy a good book, or a really good discussion, or thinking. It's marvelous. Unfortunately, people have gone crazy, and they're getting more and more addicted because they do not know how to enjoy the lovely things of life. So they're going in for greater and greater artificial stimulants. In the 1970s, President Jimmy Carter appealed to the American people to go in for austerity. I thought to myself, he shouldn't tell them to be austere. He should really tell them to enjoy things. Most of them have lost their capacity for enjoyment. I really believe that most people in affluent countries have lost that capacity. DeMello himself was an Indian, lived in India, although he traveled to this country quite a bit. They've got to have more and more expensive gadgets. They can't enjoy the simple things of life. They're overworked. Go, go, go. If you really enjoy life and the simple pleasures of the senses, you'll be amazed. You'll develop that extraordinary discipline of the animal. An animal will never overeat. Left in its natural habitat, it will never be overweight. It will never drink or eat anything that's not good for its health. I'm not absolutely sure if that's true, but I think if I left my dog alone in a room full of bacon. Of course, that's not his natural habitat. But you never find an animal smoking. See, I've heard you can teach a pig to smoke. It takes a lot of time, but what's time to a pig? It always exercises as much as it needs. Watch your cat after it's had its breakfast. Look how it relaxes. And see how it springs into action. Look at the suppleness of its limbs and the aliveness of its body. We've lost that. We've lost in our minds, in our ideas and ideals and so on, and it's always go, go, go. And we've got an inner self conflict which animals don't have. And we're always condemning ourselves and making ourselves feel guilty. I could have said of myself what one Jesuit friend said to me some years ago, take that plate of sweets away, because in front of a plate of sweets or chocolates, here's technology, because in front of a plate of sweets or chocolates, I lose my freedom. That was true of me too. I lost my freedom in front of all kinds of things, but no more. I'm satisfied with very little, and I enjoy it intensely. When you've enjoyed something intensely, you need very little. Slow down and taste and smell and hear and let your senses come alive. If you want a royal road to mysticism, sit down quietly and listen to all the sounds around you. We have everything we need. There's just so much available. Our difficulty is choosing what we want. And so it's worth working at. I guess that's the main thing I want to say. And of course, like any talk, this is directed at me as well as at you. In another place, DeMello talks about walking into a music store and it's full of all these amazing recordings, but nobody has time to listen to them. You know, we can learn to pay attention to what works and change our behaviors. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. It's being the architect of our own lives. It's waking up to the fact that we don't have to drift. The more I've been in this job at the center, the more I realize how easy it is for people to drift off in directions that they never intended. How many people I hear say, I'm hoping to get to Sesshin soon, and then 5 years go by. We don't have that many years. A whole life goes by. And yet, we've got right now. Here it is. It's going to be a nice day today. I urge you to take a walk. I think with that, we'll stop and recite the four vows.